Hey guys, make sure to join us for the 2022 Phoenix Magazine Dish Fest coming February 27th at the Clayton House in Scottsdale. The breezy, open, indoor-outdoor environment will include bites and samples from many of the restaurants and dishes featured in our current issue, the 101 Best Dishes in the Valley. Again, that's February 27th at the Clayton House. Look for all the info online right now on the homepage at phoenixmag.com.
This week on Desert Digest, the dining podcast of Phoenix Magazine, we're going to be talking mead with Arizona's leading practitioner of fermented honey beverages, Jeff Herbert from Superstition Meadery. And it is a wonderful topic. You're going to enjoy it, along with all things dining related, news and notes here on Desert Digest. I'll tell anybody who listens, and I have been telling this for a while, that the best beverage town in Arizona is Prescott, because they've got, you know, they got beer, they have wine, or at least they did, they have spirits, but most importantly, maybe most critically, they have America's best mead.
Yes.
Superstition Meadery. And we have the owner of said meadery here in studio, virtual studio. Jeff, do you go Herbert or Herbert?
It's Herbert. Yeah. Sure. It's English. I had a lacrosse coach that called me A-Bear all the time, but
That's less pretentious than Lee and me. We both go, I go Outhier. It could just be Outhier.
You're right.
And Leah could be Lemoyne, but Lemois.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming and talking to us about what you do. And you really have America's best mead. I think you were, wasn't there a ranking of, like top 100, you know, sometimes people think of mead as a brewed beverage, sometimes as a fermented beverage. And I know that you've kind of appeared on various lists. Like, am I correct on that?
Absolutely. So along with Superstition, there are a handful of other producers of mead in America, right, and even in Europe, who have been recognized as being at the top of the game in pushing innovation forwards with different techniques, barrel aging, flavor combinations. So I'm hesitant to say who's number one, but we're definitely up there with some esteemed colleagues. And from year to year, I think that sort of changes. You know, there have been times where on different lists, whether it's from Rate Beer or looking at Untappd ratings, which if your listeners aren't familiar, are two of the sort of most involved ways that craft beer fans have gotten together, sort of historically with Rate Beer and contemporarily with Untappd, all around the world to share. It's like social media in a way for beer geeks.
And it's awesome. It really has elevated. And you guys were number 35, the 35 ranked brewery in the United States by Rate Beer in 2018, which is what I was trying to pick out of my.
Oh yeah, and
so impressive.
They have last time I looked, like 11 million ratings of mostly beer, but also some sake, some mead, some cider. And we have been considered a top 100 brewer in the world, or craft beverage maker, for several years running. And we're really proud of that. So that comes from the most sort of committed fans out there who are really, they want to share it with the world.
It's true. When you get fans who are motivated, who know social media, it does pay off. Now you're obviously based in Prescott. You started there. You're originated in Prescott. You have a great Phoenix imprint too. We'll talk about that and, you know, maybe some more mead philosophy. But first let's do our news and notes section. We call it tip of the tongue. And, you know, in terms of Valley brew or Valley dining news this week, I think the big thing that came out was that one of our favorite restaurants and bakeries, Super Chunk, and its affiliated restaurant, New Wave Market?
Yes, New Wave Market.
With Sergio and Country are closing, unfortunately. I guess they're moving to Chicago?
That's what I heard. Yeah. I'm so sad. I went and had like a last meal there a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
I was just like taking pictures of everything.
I mean, the New Wave Market had some of the best sandwiches in the Valley. Chicken schmaltz. We always like went gaga over that.
It's on our best dishes list. I wrote that blurb.
That's right, you did. And then they also had a dessert in our best dishes list, the John and Yoko. Absolutely. I was going to ask you to write maybe a like a haiku about that, Lee, because I know how dearly you loved it.
I should, yeah.
Jeff, did you ever go over there? Did you ever eat at those places?
No, but I'm getting hungry because I haven't eaten. Yeah, right. You guys saw it. It sounds awesome.
Yeah, it totally is. What do you eat when you're in the Valley, Jeff? I mean, you're based mostly in Prescott. I mean, that's where you do most of your brewing. But, you know, you come into the Valley, you have a restaurant and a brewery here. Any place that you particularly love?
Most of the time, I'm actually eating at our place, somewhat just because of convenience and business reasons. I happen to love the food as well.
Yep.
But, you know, my favorite place I found in the Valley recently is Harumi for sushi. So I think that that's just fantastic. I mean, it's some of the best sushi I've ever had. I've been to the old fish market in Tokyo before they closed and they reopened a new one. So I've like eaten around like what many consider to be like the coolest place in the world for,
You've eaten fish at ground zero for fish.
So I'm a bit of a geek when it comes to this. So I can appreciate it anyways. And I'm also, you know, once a year I'll go fishing with the kids and catch. I actually was smoking a bluefin on the grill that we caught last summer a couple of days ago. So I'm definitely a fish geek. So Harumi's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and then, you got bluefin. Did you find that Lake Pleasant? Where'd you go to get that?
we were about a couple hours south of San Diego. So we were in international waters off the coast of Ensenada, basically.
Awesome. That's where you want to get it. That's wonderful. Harumi's downtown, right? The sushi place you mentioned. It's
exactly.
Yeah.
So, I love that
not place.
Far from us.
I asked sushi. Coolest thing I had so far. There's a new kind of to-go sushi concept near my house, kind of in North Central Phoenix near Sunny Slope. It's called Sushi Friend.
Okay. And I'm writing that down.
Yeah, it's great. It's a tiny place, only 5 seats. And, you know, he doesn't have the biggest selection, but the fish is impeccable. His name's Kevin, the guy who owns it. He's a one-man band there. I guess he used to work for Stingray when Stingray was around the sushi place here in the Valley. He also worked for that wonderful Japanese restaurant in North Scottsdale. What's it called? It's Roku Akor. That's legit. I mean, if you've been to Roku Akor or worked there, I imagine you know your stuff. And yeah, you order mostly online. You can order via an app and it's beautiful stuff. The fish is great. It travels really well. You know, it's mostly designed to take home. But great if you're, you know, in that area. Sushi Friend, kind of a catchy name too. But Leah, do anything this week that you'd want to talk about?
No, I'm going to have to remember the sushi one, though, because my partner loves sushi. I'm not a big fan, but it usually does not travel well. That's been our experience. So it's good to know that there is some that does. And, you know, we live in North Phoenix, so that's really close to us. So that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Sushi, sometimes when it you get over refrigerated or whatever, it dries out on the way home, but not this stuff. It was impeccable from start to finish. So, you know, Jeff, we mentioned your restaurant, you know, and being downtown. I mean, that's where you opened your local imprint of Superstition Meadery. And it wasn't just the meadery. You actually, you know, it was an awesome restaurant with an amazing menu. I went last year, or actually 2 years ago, late in 2011, you opened? I mean, 2019, sorry.
Exactly. So, yeah, we opened you know, just over a year ago now. And we have our first full year behind us. So it was, November 2020. We just got through our first year of 21. And we've learned a lot of lessons. We were, you know, kind of crazy to try and open a restaurant, especially with a new concept of the world's first meat and food pairing restaurant during the pandemic. Right. But we were so committed to the process of renovating the building. You know, we purchased the building itself and went through this really long design phase, even rezoning. I mean, it took 6 months to rezone the building. So that's a long, boring story, but we were successful in doing that. And
it's great when restaurateurs like yourself find old buildings though, and resurrect them. And there's always just a better vibe, you know, than if it's a strip mall or a scratch build.
Absolutely. The building's so cool. It was built in 1928, and it's the first Chinese grocery store in Phoenix. And actually, that part of town, no one really knows, but that was Chinatown back in the day.
I mean, we're talking like kind of that South Garfield area, 12th Street and Washington-ish?
Yeah, so that's a light rail stop. So we're right off the light rail. So we're 1110 East Washington.
Yeah.
And it was called the Jim Ong's Market. And I used to work for the Phoenix Fire Department. And it turns out that a current Phoenix chief actually grew up as a kid in that market, because that was his grandfather's place.
Oh, no way. So, that's amazing.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, you were one of our best new restaurants of 2021. And we included, you know, the latter couple months of 2020, just because of the way it works out. And when I went there for the first time, and I knew you guys were opening because I had talked to you, I think interviewed you and done a story about the mead at one point. I mean, just fun menu. Use the grill. You had kind of little tapas dishes. I mean, all of it was fun. I mean, there was so much going on. I was excited to come back. And every time I've been back, it's been great. But tell us how you started in, let's start again from the beginning with mead. Now, you were a firefighter, but how did you develop a passion for mead and fermented honey?
So a friend of mine introduced me to home brewing probably 12 years ago, 13 years ago. And I was into craft beer at the time as a fan, but, you know, I would go to Four Peaks and stuff and, you know, went to ASU. So I knew about beer, and I was always, I'd say, more prone to have a Newcastle than a Budweiser, but I really wasn't, you know, a beer geek by any stretch. And I kept talking about this homebrew, and my wife and I, you know, we never went to cooking school or anything, but we both like cooking a lot. And it turns out that making beer is a lot like kind of making a soup at first, right? And so right. I got home from the fire station on Father's Day in, I think it was 2009, and my wife had a homebrew kit for me, and I just dove in. And so I was making beer once a week, but I started making mead right away, maybe once a month. And then I started making cider eventually, but it turned out that my first meads were way better than my first beer. So I thought, maybe I'm onto something. And at the time, there were only a couple of commercial examples of mead, like maybe four meads in the state you could even find. Starting brewery, and you'd only had like four beers in your life. Like that's what we did when we started our company.
Wouldn't so even taste up, like beer. You'd be, you know, you could do anything.
Yeah. That's kind of how I started with making mead. I was inspired by, you know, some of the early results, and I like research a lot. You know, I went to grad school at ASU as well. So that's kind of how I think. I like to plan things out and then, you know, put that plan into action, adapt as we need to. And so I thought, I need to learn how to have a business. I need to learn how to have a brewery, a winery, something to figure out this whole mead thing. And right. So I took a class in Chicago at the Siebel Institute. And so Siebel, along with a couple other places around the country and the world, it's like one of the best places to become a brewer. And I took the second class they ever taught on how to start a brewery. And the first question they asked to 40 people from all around the country, even like Alaska, some guy came from Panama. They said, who here is an award-winning home brewer? And I looked at everyone but me raised their hand. I looked at the guy next to me and I said, they have awards for this stuff? Like, I didn't have friends that did it. I just, you know, was learning online, reading magazines and books. And so I got home. I learned like how to write a business plan in this class and all. Started working on the business plan, started entering my homebrewed meads and beers and contests, started winning awards right away. And the judges in those homebrew contests give you, you know, really good feedback, how to like change things that aren't great and let you know what's good. And I was, again, just sort of like, maybe I can figure this out. And a lot of firemen have side jobs. A lot of times,
did you retire from the fire department at that point, or were you still working?
Oh no. So, you know, part of being a firefighter and you know, is getting that pension once you've earned it after 20 years or 25 years or more. And so for me, the goal was to finish the career. And at the same time, that allowed me to, you know, cover our personal expenses as entrepreneurs and just continue to reinvest pretty much everything that the company made. Yeah, we were successful from year one. It allowed us to, you know, to grow Superstition more so with just my wife and I as the only owners. Like, we don't have investors. We have a couple loans at this point, but it's just her and I, and we were able to grow this thing organically and fuel it as we went on.
So, right, because firefighters go 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off. So would you have these kind of like, you know, blocks of time where you could devote to the project?
So when I was a Phoenix firefighter, we would work for 24 hours at a time and have 48 hours off. And when you're up all night, I mean, you're just a zombie and you know,
right.
Gosh, that's a whole nother story. But yes, there was time. You had to create time, and no one would believe the actual hours I worked in order to make this happen. And just like, I mean, any guy or gal in the job that has, you know, that does, you know, real estate or construction, sometimes that's on the side. You can always work a lot of overtime. That's something happening these days for sure, because of the times we're in. But anyways, I used that spare time to, you know, to be a dad and to work on, you know, creating this business plan and growing a business along with my wife. She was still working full time as well for the first maybe 6 years of Superstition before she went full time with Superstition. And we realized after the first 2 years, when we moved from Skull Valley, while we were renting space, we were the first alternating proprietorship in Arizona. That's where one separate licensed winery rent space from another. So we were responsible for all of our clients, you know, paying the taxes and everything, label approvals or whatnot. And we wound up moving to our current tasting room space in Prescott, which was a production facility and a tasting room that we opened in 2014. So 2 years after we got going. And that's when we realized there's no choice but to begin to, you know, train and hire employees. And so we started to develop a production staff, our tasting room staff. And then within a couple of years of saving a little bit of money, enough for a down payment for a loan, we acquired some land and built from scratch and designed like on bar napkins, traveling around, talking to mentors in the industry, state-of-the-art production facility.
So, I mean, a lot of people at this point probably still don't know the story behind Mead. Maybe we can do a five facts about Mead, you know, primer for them. Now, I think the obvious part is that it's made from honey, generally. So I'm going to ask you, older than beer, not as old as beer. What's the prevailing thought on that?
So people will make different claims, but what we know, I think what we can agree on scientifically is that the oldest fermented beverage that's been tested was from an area called Chateau Jiahu in China 9,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And Dogfish Head even did a recreation of this beverage. And this research was done by Patrick McGovern, who's a biomolecular archaeologist from the University of Pennsylvania. He's written some really cool books if you geek out on this stuff. And they tested this ceramic jar. And there was this residue through mass spectrometry and whatnot. They were able to determine that they're either grape or hop. Getting some fruit component of this beverage. There was some rice and there was honey. And so depending on your definition of a honey beer or a wine with rice or whatnot,
so like honey was
a component.
Sake, yeah. Something, right.
So honey was definitely a component, the oldest confirmed beverage.
9,000 years.
Yeah. So we say Mead is the oldest fermented beverage. And, you know, There are other theories and whatnot that go beyond. So mead is, honey was part of that. Honey defines mead. Honey provides the primary fermentable sugar in almost everything that we make that's you know, considered a mead for sure. We also do some cider where, you know, apples are providing the fermentable sugar.
In that sense, it's a little, not as complex as beer, because beer, you have to coax the sugar out of the grain, whatever grain you're using. With mead, you have the honey right there ready to go. So I guess that kind of dovetails into my next question. Is it brewed like beer? Is it fermented like wine or distilled?
It's fermented like wine. And like you just referred to, when you're making a sake or when you're making a beer, you have to convert the sugars in the grains in order to ferment them. And you do that through some various methods of brewing where you have to heat with water, some other liquid to certain temperatures to make that conversion happen. So yes, we are able to take fruit juice. We're able to crush fruit. We're able to take honey. We're able to use some Belgian dark candy sugar, different things that wineries use and ferment those. Now beer is also fermented and anything distilled first has to be fermented as well.
Right.
So
heat it, right? The brewing is sort of the heating.
Do not heat at all.
Gotcha.
And so when you get honey over about 100 degrees, you'll start to lose some volatile aromatic compounds. So those aromas that you want, the flavors that you want will be best retained if you actually don't use heat. So that means that it's kind of like, so in brewing, there's hot side and cold side brewing. And so once the beer's cooled, anything that comes in contact with that beer, the pipes, anything you're stirring, has to be totally clean. And so everything's cleaned and sanitized before we begin to make any of our products, just like you would use in a winery. And legally, we are a winery at the federal level, at the state level. So the difference in America between people who make alcohol is you're either a brewery, which means you're pretty much using cereal grains, everything that you do. There's like a recent sort of carve out for types of seltzers. As a winery, we are not allowed to use cereal grains. Technically, we can't have a packet of oatmeal in our winery because that's a cereal grain.
Right.
And as a distiller, you can make beer and distill it into whiskey, or you can make wine and distill it into, you know, grappa or whatnot.
Yeah. Okay. So mostly fermented is kind of the...
Absolutely.
Sure. Yeah. What country consumes the most mead per capita? Like, is there a country that still has the most mead crazy? And how do you guys do there?
Ethiopia and Poland are two places where mead is still a national beverage. And there's not a single like licensed meadery in Ethiopia. And they make a drink called Tej. They use gesho, which is this desert plant that's kind of like hops. So it provides a bitterness to counter the sweetness that often exists in mead. Right. And then Poland makes mostly traditional meads. They also use, which is honey, water, and yeast, but they'll also do some fruit mead, some barrel aging. And the largest mead competition in Europe is held in Poland, and we've entered it and won some award. We're actually a sponsor of it. It's happening in a couple of weeks.
No kidding. Do you ever go out, or have you been there?
I have not been to Poland, but we did send some staff to a festival in Poland and to do a collaboration with the brewery over there, where we made a braget, which is a style of mead that a brewery can make because there's honey and cereal grains.
And you mentioned how, you know, mead can incorporate hops, not just fruit juice. Obviously, you can do fruit juice and you get fruit flavors in your mead, but also, you know, bittering agents to make it, you know, more food friendly, that kind of thing. How long does mead last in the fridge after you popped it open? Like, do you, like wine, do you have to drink it after a while? Even beer, you have to, because it'll lose ferment, you know.
So if you open a beer, you've got, you know, an hour or two probably before, you know, you're going to lose some bulk. So I say with beer, you've got hours. With wine, you have days. And with mead, you have weeks or months. And so the higher the alcohol content and the higher the sugar content, like the more sweetness that you get, like think about port or a late harvest wine. I found that those types of products, and I don't know chemically why the sweetness makes a difference, but those things will still taste good if you cork it, or like in our case, put a flip top back on a 750, stick it in your fridge. I've forgotten about meads before, where I'm like looking for a beer in my fridge. I'm like, oh, look at this mead from like 6 months ago. And if it's sweeter with enough alcohol, it's, I'm like, it'll change. It'll oxidize slowly, it's still delicious. And so if you wanted to have mead as part of like a cocktail program, you don't have to worry about it going bad like wine.
Like wine, right? You know, the same with vermouth. Like, you can keep a nice vermouth in the fridge for 2-3 months. It's still quite good, like a Antica or something. And it, yeah, I think the sugar is a preservative on some level, right? So, and what you mentioned, the alcohol, what does a mead usually clock in terms of its ABV?
13 to 14%, like most, you know, red and white wines, but we also make session meads. And so it's kind of funny because in the beer world, a session beer is something usually like 4% alcohol. And in the mead world, it's under 10. And so we have cans of mead that are, you know, 6% to 6.9% ABV that are out in the market. We have new cans coming out every month. And so that's the kind of thing, you know, if you're drinking 16 ounces of something, if it was 14%, you're going to sip on it and to maybe hopefully spread that out over a meal. But, you know, you can drink our cans, like kind of where you would drink an IPA, you know.
Last question. Is there a sexier beverage on the planet than mead? Didn't mead inspire the whole concept of honeymoon?
Absolutely. So in many cultures, there was a tradition of giving a newlywed couple a cycle of the moon or a month's supply of mead.
Right.
And that had to do with this, you know, sort of arranged marriage tradition that often existed. And so it would break down barriers, allow people that really didn't know each other to try and get to know each other in order to start a family, right? That was the ultimate goal of most traditional marriages going back in time. And so mead is known as the original aphrodisiac on account of that tradition in history.
And what a month that would have been.
Absolutely.
It's like a speed dating round that just doesn't ever end. And lots of alcohol. That's fun.
And that's so funny because your Hawaiian honeymoon mead, which I love, it's kind of my go-to present for my friends who are getting married. And I wasn't even aware of the history, but in a lot of them have gone on Hawaiian honeymoon. So I'm like, oh, look here, you can prolong your honeymoon when you get home with this fun mead. So that's fun.
I wish I knew you when I got married.
As well.
I like, my favorite mead of yours, Jeff, is the one with hops in it. What do you call that one?
Would be your favorite.
So we have Juiciest Caesar has grapefruit and hops. War Honey has lemon and hops.
Right.
And those are seasonal for us, but they often are around for a while. And they're absolutely delicious. And
they totally are.
It's really fun to pair those with food. But we do like bone dry meads that age in bourbon barrels. We do really sweet dessert meads. We do carbonated and sparkling beverages, everything in between. So if you were to visit our place in Phoenix, I think we have over 60 products you could actually take home with you if you wanted. That doesn't even count our reserve program. We have 24 taps. They're all different. So you'll get to try, you know, like a really amazing range. So just like if
You have the best flight I've ever had. It's your main flight. I think is it 12?
It's 12 and it changes every week.
And it's awesome. I mean, it really is a great, crash course in mead. The first time I had ever consumed it in volume. And I mean, there is a great range of styles and flavors. I mean, it's so much fun. I think it's the best flight around. So
cool. Thanks. I'm glad you got to try it.
You make a mead that has, I think that the hops meads you talk great does deep too. They're perfect for just after meal thing. They settle the stomach. You also make one that's red wine forward, which you compare, I guess, with red meat is the idea.
Absolutely. So there's a style of mead. There are all these weird terms we have, right? So if you have a mead that's made with spices, it's called a metheglin, which is the Welsh word for medicine. We used to make medicine out of alcohol, right? And then if you ferment wine grapes with honey, it's called a piment. And so piments are my favorite style of mead, like hands down. I got goosebumps thinking about it. I'm like thirsty right now. And so we do piments out of white wine that will age in barrels or not. We do piments out of different red wine grapes. And to me, it's really close to a port. And if you take a piment and put it like a red wine and honey fermented beverage, put that into a spirit barrel and extract some of that essence and spirit and ABV out of what was, a scotch barrel, bourbon barrel, gin barrel, vermouth barrel. Now have something that's like a port if port was in those different spirits barrels. And I love sipping on those. And yeah, they're amazing with meat for sure.
And you say it makes it drier too? Those are some of your drier styles that have been barrel aged?
So my favorite dry mead is Lagrimas de Oro or Tears of Gold in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And we use Arizona mesquite honey. And we make that into a mead that then goes into a freshly dumped rack and in there minimum of 3 months, sometimes 12. It depends on, what was going on in that barrel. There's a lot of science on the forefront end of making mead, and there's a lot of art on the back end where it's ready when it's ready. I know I've talked to new hires before where they're like, when's this thing going to be ready? And I'll say, like, when the barrel like says it's ready, and they think I'm
whispers
joking
to me.
Oh, really? We got to go pull a nail and try it. So if you guys get a chance to come up and see our production facility, after we go through how mead's made, we're going to spend most of our time in the barrel room. We'll pull some nails. We use stainless steel nails and the thickest head stave of every barrel to take samples to an inch of oak. And that's a lot of fun.
Do you tours up there? Like what's the
only twice routine? A year. So we have a guild, which is a membership program where people spend about $400 a year to get that same value in very special bottles. We curate and make for the guild. Plus they get their own web store and there's other benefits. So we'll do a tour for the guild once a year when we do our guild gathering. It's going to be in the end of March this year. But awesome. Then usually we'll also have an event called Berry White Day. And so Berry White is sort of our most famous mead. It's raspberries and vanilla and white chocolate aged in new American oak. Definitely a dessert beverage. And so we do a festival every year called Berry White Day. And we will open up production that day as well. So we are so packed. Like if you come to visit us right now, like my parents are in town visiting from Maryland. And the last time my dad came out, we had to scoot through our forklift on a Saturday afternoon just to get to the door to go to the barrel room. So we have a new warehouse. It's almost ready in April. But so we open up twice a year. So if you follow us on social media, you can know when those things happen. And I wish we could do tours more often, but there's two forklifts moving around and
pallet bandwidth,
and pumps and tubing. It's just not set up for that.
What a great gift though for a beverage enthusiast. That would be an excellent gift. What would also be a good gift coming to Dish Fest, what we're doing at the end of the month, which you're going to be pouring
it. That's our first foodie like festival we're a part of. And it's such an honor.
You and me both, brother.
By you guys. So it's going to be a blast.
Do you know you'll be pouring at Dish Fest by any chance? Do you have an idea?
Usually for something like this, we're going to bring something to pair with the dish that we make. And we're working on a brand new novel for us, a pineapple upside down cake that'll be single serve and produced with mead in some way. And so I have to taste it to determine what the pairing will be.
Right.
So we'll probably bring a dedicated pairing for what we're going to be serving to eat. But then we'll probably also bring a nice selection of bottles and cans that we'll serve up so that people can have a really cool experience. And maybe even as they go around the festival, find some things they really like. And then maybe come back over to our booth, for example, and try a mead and think, oh, wow, now, the sum is greater, right?
So oh yeah, and pairing, maybe going back, having some food and thinking, hey, that taste I had over at Superstition would go perfectly with this. I could see that becoming just a fun way to spend 2 hours, but you know, let's move on. Well, thanks for Jed for talking about what you do and you know, all the nuances. I didn't even get to like talking to you about honey. I imagine you've become a honey aficionado. You mentioned the mesquite honey from here in Arizona that you use for one of your styles. I bet there's just a whole panoply of honey.
Oh yeah. You know? The coolest like way to experience honey, like, and I would recommend someone come in quick because these bottles are so limited. But for our 9-year anniversary, we made 9 different meads from 9 different apiaries all around the state. And there's a map of where the bees were flying on every label. And then the 10th one is a blend of all 9, which signifies getting into our 10th year. So we have this traditional, right? Oh, yeah. You can come into Superstition downtown and actually try honey from all across the state and see like where the bees were flying that made it. And we have crucifixion thorn, wildflower honey, which is a blend of honeys. There's cat claw, all these different types of honeys that create flavors that you would never expect. Like, how do you get tropical fruit flavors out of a desert honey? Like for me, it's like mind blowing to see how the honey starts and then how, you know, when fermentation happens, the yeast we choose, what happens in the end product. It's a lot of fun.
You are an evangelist of honey and mead, sir. I'm kind of wanting to devote my life to it now, just talking to you.
My business card says mead ambassador.
So there you go.
That's my job.
Leo, what do you got for us? We do a, you know, you find a trend. I hope it's mead or honey related every week. We talk about it.
It might be a good pairing for mead. We'll have to get Jeff's input. But I read an interesting article on Eater about the flamin' hotification of snacks. So we've all heard of flamin' hot cheese, but now giving them so max. They just came out with flamin' hot sour cream and cheddar ruffles in collaboration with LeBron James. They have this whole list. They have flamin' hot Doritos, smart food popcorn, kettle cooked things. So just no end to this. So are you guys into this? I'm a spice wimp, so I can't handle this. I'm like, I have a toddler's palate, but perhaps you guys like a little spice. It seems like most of America does.
Absolutely. I roll up Takis in Turkey for like a zero sugar snack.
That's a quick lunch right there. What about, there is an interesting angle here, spicy food, you know, which can be hard to pair wine with spicy food. What about mead? Like, how would you go, say you had, you know, a spicy Thai dish or Indian dish, what would you pair it with?
So we're doing a Valentine's Day prefix menu option from Friday to Monday over Valentine's Day weekend coming up. And, you know, there's 4 things and you can choose to get the mead pairing with it. So I was just down yesterday trying these things for the first time. And one of the dishes is like a shumai, which is like a dumpling that's steamed and then crisped up. And the inside of the shumai has lobster and shrimp. And then we have this spicy and sweet Asian sauce that these 3 are set in, kind of like ninja stars. And there's some jalapeno slices. And so I was trying to figure out which mead is going to pair with this. And I chose this mead called Flamingo Croquet, which was a collab we did with a meadery from Sweden years ago. And we still make it once a year. We use organic Arizona apple cider from the only commercial cider press in the state, and we use Hatch chilies. And so for me, a capsomel is a mead with spicy peppers in it. I don't ever want to have, like, I am drinking salsa when I have a beverage, right? So it should be like a supporting component. And so we have a little spice, just a touch of heat, and a bit of earthiness and minerality that is contributed from the Hatch chilies. But then we have this sweet apple mead we call a sizer. So you're going to get some apple and some honey. And so there's this really complementary interplay between this sweet and spicy sauce. But for me, that jalapeno thin slice was just popped, and it accentuated, like, it took the mild hatchness to this other level, and they work together to create a flavor that, again, you don't get from the bite, you don't get from the drink. And when you have it together and it's swirling around your palate, you've created a flavor on your own, right? Which is the point of mead and food pairing, or wine and beer and food pairing, that is now brand new to you and you've never had it before. So yes, absolutely. With spicy stuff, there's some pretty cool things we could do with mead.
It sounds like a natural, because, you know, usually the best wines with spicy food are like these kind of, you know, sweeter whites, like Gewürztraminer and that kind of thing, Riesling. So mead's right there. And that, the way you described it, I'm convinced. Well, thank you for coming in, Jeff. It was great talking to you. I feel like we could spend you know, a couple more shows talking about the intricacies and nuances of weed. Meat.
We can do that show too.
Yeah, right.
And now it's legal.
Uh-oh. There's another topic for a show. Well, thank you very much for coming in. We'll see you later.
Cool. It's my pleasure, guys. Thank you.